Okay, so let's just remind ourselves the Schwarzschild metric. So we showed that's the most general spherically symmetric solution of the vacuum Einstein equations. And as I mentioned, it's not really the most physically relevant one because it's spherically symmetric, whereas the most general stationary black hole, stationary means that the object is the same at all times. Okay, it may be rotating, but it's the same at all times. And the most general stationary solution of the Einstein equations doesn't have spherical symmetry, it has axial symmetry, and it's the Kerr black hole, and that's what the generic black hole is in the universe. But for simplicity, we're studying the black hole. The Kerr black hole, in the limit that the angular momentum is zero, is the Schwarzschild black hole. And so at least this metric is relevant for slowly spinning black holes. But it's a good start in dealing with black holes. And I noticed yesterday everybody got very excited about black holes. I could hardly leave the lecture room. And for some reason, they have this effect on everyone, you know, the black hole, it's very mysterious. So the French were absolutely wrong. This name has excited everybody's imagination. And then, of course, the universe turns out to be full of these things. So even esoteric subjects like string theory are we're seeing objects where perhaps string theory is relevant. Okay. So what we're going to do now first is to study particle trajectories in particles and photons. Particle and photon trajectories, let's say geodesics, in the Schwarzschild metric. And so more physically, we can say that we're going to imagine falling into a black hole, and we want to know what we would see. So first of all, the action for the geodesic, it's always easiest to begin directly with the action rather than the geodesic equation. And I think, as I've explained before, if you have some symmetry which will be preserved by the equations of motion, you can use that directly in the action. You can impose that symmetry on the action, and you won't be losing any information. In general, it's not correct to plug an ansatz into the action. You won't get the equations of motion because your ansatz may not be sufficiently general. But if you have a situation of symmetry, then it's fine. And in any case, we're going to use the action to figure out the trajectories of these particles. Now, the action I want to use is not the one we used before. So recall we had the action is equal to minus the mass integral the proper time along the particle geodesic, which was equal to minus m integral square root minus g mu nu x dot nu d, let's call it lambda, where x dot means dx d lambda. That's a good action because it's invariant under reparameterizing lambda. So it doesn't really matter what lambda is as long as it's a good parameterization. This action is exactly the same, whatever lambda is. It's not a nice action because it has a square root in it. And so it's often useful to use a different action, an improved action, which has no square root, and the improved action is just m over 2 integral g mu nu x dot nu d lambda over E minus, yeah, I just hope I've got the dimensions right. We should, okay, let me just check the dimensions. If I'm going to leave C's in, then I better put them up here. No, that's right. It's actually MC. We can check it because minus M. What I want is MC squared integral dt square root 1 minus dx dt squared 1 over c squared, because when I expand that out, I'm going to get a half mv squared, and the c squareds will cancel. And I'll get, of course, the E equals mc squared potential energy. So in flat space, so if g equals eta, and remember, x naught is ct. So there are two factors of C here. When I pull that out of the square root, I'm going to get MC squared. So I think there's a C here. And so presumably there's a C here. Yeah, that's correct. No, I'm sorry. I think there's no C there. There's no C there. Okay. So this is an improved action. So it's a little strange. I introduced an extra quantity, E. We call E the Einbein. It's the square root of the 1D metric on the world line. And the property of E is that if lambda goes to lambda twiddle of lambda, then E goes to goes to d lambda twiddle times E. So E d lambda is invariant. Is invariant under reparameterizations of the world line. So you can think about it as the square root. E d lambda is the square root of the one-dimensional line element. Now, the reason for doing this, so basically I've introduced, in addition to the x mu parameterizing the line, I've introduced this e. The reason for doing that is that there's no square root in this action, and so this action is much better for quantization. When you work out the Hamiltonian, it will be polynomial function of the momenta and g. It won't involve any square root, and so it's much easier to quantize. So the advantage, no square root, and easier to quantize. We're not going to quantize it, of course, but nevertheless, it'll be useful to know that this action exists. And if I vary with respect to E, so I'm supposed to view this action as a function of x mu, the trajectory, and also E. So if I vary with respect to E, from the first term I get minus g mu nu x dot nu over E squared. And from the second term I get minus C squared. And so that tells me that E is equal to minus the square root. Let me just check that I have. So E is equal to, minus the square root of 1 over C times minus g mu nu x dot mu x dot mu. And so now I can substitute back in the action. And what I see is that I get S equals, so the E gives me minus 1 over the square root of the thing on top. It gives me minus the square root, so what I'm left with is minus m over 2, and then sorry, I don't want a minus there, I want a plus. E is defined to be positive. Okay, so then this is equal to mc square root minus g mu nu x dot nu. And I get exactly the same factor from here. So there's a factor of 2, and basically that's the answer. So two of these two terms give the same contribution, and I end up with this action. Okay, so that action is equivalent to the square root action, but it's more general because this action has an extra symmetry, has an extra, this action has no square root, it has the same symmetry that you can reparameterize, and it's invariant. Okay, so this action is often very useful to use. Yep.
Is E just basically a constraint?
Is E like a Lagrange multiplier. If you do Lagrange multipliers, you add another parameter in the variational principle, and when you vary with respect to it, it imposes a constraint. So what you can think about is this equation here. You see, this equation is that the four velocity u mu u nu is equal to minus c squared. Okay, so the four velocity is x, so u mu is equal to x dot mu over e, because this is invariant. This is invariant under reparameterization. And the equation here just means, just reads that u mu u nu is minus c squared. So another advantage of this action is that immediately you obtain this formula here. Remember, before we had the fact that the four velocity was minus 1. I was using units where c equals 1. Or maybe I had redefined the four velocity to have the c in it. I can't remember. This equation gives you that that the square of the four velocity is minus 1. So if you start with this action, then you obtain both this constraint and you obtain the geodesic equation. Yeah.
When I construct the action, I construct it from the Lagrangian, which in general, in this case, for a free particle, is just the kinetic energy, right? So my question is, you can...
You're worried about the extra term?
No. I'm worried about the way, in which case you can take off the square root and in which case you can't. Because I can construct the Lagrangian just by the kinetic energy, which is the square of the velocity, right?
That's not true for relativistic mechanics, is it?
Right, but I can parameterize by the proper time. That's something we saw in the tutorial.
A kinetic Lagrangian equals the Hamiltonian is only true in Newtonian mechanics, I think.
Yeah. Hamiltonian for a relativistic particle is actually zero.
Right, but I mean, your Lagrangian can be just...
We can work that out.
The x, g mu nu, x dot mu, x dot mu, right?
Sorry?
You can consider your Lagrangian to be g mu nu, x dot mu, x dot mu.
You can.
And parameterized only by the proper time, and you get...
Yes, this right? Action is better because the time is arbitrary here. You see, the problem with the proper time is it's meaningless for a photon. Photon has zero proper time along the trajectory. The geodesic equation is an equation for... straight lines in a curved space-time, and it applies equally well to a photon, where the parameter along the geodesic is the affine parameter along the geodesic. Okay, so this action generalizes to a photon very nicely. In fact, what I do, you see, I've got an m out the front there. For a photon, an m is zero. M is zero, so I can't use it in this form. I have to do two things. We'll do that in a moment. Okay, but for now, what I want to emphasize is that this action, if I vary with respect to E, then I get u mu, u nu, g mu nu equals minus c squared. And if I vary with respect to x, then I get the geodesic equation. And what I'm actually going to get, if you do work it out carefully, you're going to get d2x d tau squared, I'll tell you what tau is, equal plus gamma mu nu lambda dx nu d tau dx lambda d tau equals 0, where d tau is equal to e d lambda. And this quantity is reparameterization invariant. Okay.
After vary with respect to e, is that an equals minus e squared or a
lower? Sorry,
c.
C. C. I'm trying to keep my c's. I'm not quite sure why, but today I'm trying to keep the c's right. And u is the velocity, so it has dimensions of c. The metric is dimensionless. Okay, so that's for a massive particle. This is a nice action. No square root gives both the constraint and the geodesic equation. For a photon, m equals zero, we use instead an action, the action constant, some constant over 2, x dot mu over e, g mu nu d lambda, where c is identified. So that has no second term. The photon is massless. And so there's no potential energy term. Well, there's no minus c squared e term. And c is identified with the magnitude of the momentum for the photon. So photon has an energy. And you can see when I vary this action with respect to x dot mu, p mu will be, it's actually got a lower index. The momentum associated with the coordinate x mu is has a lower index because x mu has an upper index. And if I work that out, I'm going to get g mu nu x dot nu, the 2 goes away, over e. and this constant c tells you what the energy of the photon is. Okay, so that's the action you should use for photons. And if you wanted to use a particle that was a tachyon, ordinary particle is a time-like trajectory. Its four velocity squared is a negative number that tells you it's going inside the light cone. A photon goes on the light cone, its four velocity squared is zero. You can see that, varying with respect to e. Delta by delta E tells me that x dot nu, g mu nu equals zero. The photon is null. If you wanted to do a tachyon, you just change the sign here. And that would force your particle to have a four velocity, which is space-like. So it would be going faster than the speed of light. And you can do that, but we've never seen such a particle. Okay, so let me just write that here. So this quantity goes to zero for a photon plus c squared e for a tachyon. And this quantity here would go to the energy, let's call it e, for a photon. Okay, so these are the actions which describe particles of different types. And there are various obvious things from it. Conserved quantities from Noether's theorem. We know that if the problem has a symmetry under translations of some coordinate, then the corresponding momentum will be conserved. Okay, so if G mu nu is independent of some coordinate, independent G mu nu of x of some coordinate, for example, for the Schwarzschild metric, e.g., Schwarzschild, the G mu nu is independent of T and it's independent of phi, T and phi, because the two-sphere metric was just d theta squared plus sine squared theta d phi squared. So G mu nu doesn't depend on phi. So the action doesn't depend on phi. Then the corresponding momenta are conserved. Okay, so we'll see this in practice. Let's just work out the action for the Schwarzschild metric. And it's convenient to work in the gauge. This means a coordinate choice, E equals 1. Okay, so if you want to work out the equations of motion for x, it's actually completely fine to just set E equals 1 and not worry about E, because the manner in which E enters the equations for the equations of motion for x is just like this. The E enters into the equations there. And so you can vary it and later choose a parameterization in which E equals 1. And all you're doing is choosing the parameterization which is proper time. So it's perfectly fine just at the outset to set E equals 1 if you want to work out the geodesics. And so in that case, the action is m over 2 integral d tau. D lambda is now equal to d tau. And then we've got no factor of E minus 1 minus 2gm over rc squared, c squared t dot squared plus r dot squared over 1 minus 2gm c squared plus r squared theta dot squared. You'll see this is easier than working out the connection, the Christoffel symbols. It's easier just to use the action directly, where dot equals d by d tau. Okay, so now we have the action. Let's get the equations of motion. Sorry. Okay, oops, went too far. Yeah.
So by setting E equals 1, are you just putting in that first constraint by hand then? The four velocity minus E squared? Or is the idea that you
yes.
put it first and then
no,
put it back in?
Exactly. By setting equals to 1, you see what this equation implies is this is x dx mu d lambda dx nu d lambda g mu nu equals minus c squared e squared. So if I set e equals to 1, then d lambda is equal to the proper time.
So the idea is that you vary first to get this constraint and then you set e equals to 1 and plug
that. Yes, exactly. So strictly speaking, when you have actions, you should be careful that you write them in the original form, vary them, write down all the equations of motion, and only then fix a gauge. Okay, if you fix the gauge in action too early, you may miss one of the equations of motion. You see, if I fixed equals one here, as in fact I'm doing now, okay, I would never get the constraint. Okay, but since I know how it works, I can just go ahead and fix E equals one, get the equations of motion for x mu, and later impose the constraint. I'm going to impose a constraint as well. Okay, so you just have to be careful not to fix things too early so that you miss one of the equations of motion. So now we get the Lagrange equations. D by dt, dl, d, x mu dot equals dl, dx mu. So those are the equations you get by varying a Lagrangian. So if we work with respect to theta, if we vary this with respect to theta, what I'm going to get here is two terms, one from this theta dot and one from the sine squared. So I'm going to get r squared theta dot dot. So that's just dl d theta dot gives me a factor of 2, which cancels the half. The m I'll ignore because it's an overall factor. And then I get dl d theta, so r squared sine theta cos theta phi dot squared. So that's the equation of motion for theta. And if you think about it, we're studying the motion of a particle in the spherically symmetric black hole. Theta is this angle. If we set our particle going at theta equals pi over 2, it's going to be going on an orbit, on an equatorial orbit. Okay, theta equals pi over 2. And you can see that theta equals pi over 2 is a solution of this equation because the right-hand side is 0. And we'll choose this from now on, just to simplify all the algebra. Okay, so we're just studying a particle going on an orbit around the equator. By rotational symmetry, that's going to be the same as any other orbit. If we just rotate it. Okay, so the particle's going on theta equals pi over 2. Theta dot is 0. And now let's vary with respect to phi. And here we expect a conserved quantity. And what we see is we have r squared sine squared theta phi dot d by d tau is equal to 0. And so that tells us theta is pi over 2. So r squared phi dot is defined to be Lz, the angular momentum around the z direction, is equal to a constant. I'm ignoring the m. Strictly speaking, the angular momentum should be m times that, but I'm just going to ignore the m everywhere. And x mu equals t, we get, this is a more complicated equation now, ct dot 1 minus 2 gm over r c squared, all d by d tau is equal to 0, because the action was independent of t. Okay, so varying with respect to t, I just get this term. I should have put a bracket in there. Sorry. Oops. There's a bracket here. And so what we get is that ct dot 1 minus 2 gm over rc squared is equal to e, which is a constant. And e has the interpretation of the energy of the particle, and it's conserved because the space time has a symmetry under time translations. So now let's use the constraint. G mu nu x dot nu equals minus c squared. And I get minus 1 minus 2 gm over r c squared e squared inverse times e squared plus 1 minus 2 gm over r c squared inverse times r dot squared plus l z squared over r squared equals minus c squared. Okay. And so that's going to be our basic equation to study the orbits of the particle. Now, it's easy to see that this is what I get for a massive particle. And if I was studying a photon, the only difference would I'd have zero here. Because the photon obeys exactly the same geodesic equation, it just has a different constraint that the four velocity is null.
Massive particles, we can interpret the parameter, the proper time, the time measured if you're carrying a clock along as you do. For photons, is there any physical interpretation of the parameter?
Or
is
arbitrary? It's arbitrary. So it's an affine parameter. But in practice, for a photon, so basically you solve the geodesic equation, you get x mu of lambda. This is an affine parameter. And then you have that the photon four momentum with a lowered index, x dot nu, with some constant, an arbitrary constant here. And so the arbitrariness in the reparameterization is sort of mirrored in this constant. You can pick a given parameterization and choose an arbitrary constant, or you can just say, I'm going to use this to, I'm going to pick that constant to 1. And then the point is that you set this quantity equal to the photon four momentum. So typically, say we're studying the microwave background radiation. The atoms in the plasma which emit the microwave background, those atoms emit a photon. And you know the energy of the photon in the rest frame of the atom. Okay, so basically, you know something like g mu nu x dot mu for the particle times x dot nu for the photon. Or let's write it this way. If an atom emits a photon, the atom has four velocity u mu of atom. And the photon has four momentum, p mu. Okay, and then the energy of the photon, as seen by the atom, as seen by the atom is equal to u mu p mu. Because in the rest frame of the atom, this four velocity is just 1, or c, in the time component. And the p mu is the p naught. And you would say that's the energy of the photon. So this equation is used to fix the constant c, or alternatively, to fix the affine parameter up to a scale. So in practice, you never even talk about energies of photons unless somebody's measuring them. And the thing measuring them better be a massive particle that has some notion of scale. Photons don't have any intrinsic scale. So the energy of a photon is only meaningful if it interacts with something which has a scale. Okay, so particle orbits. I wrote down this equation. We can rewrite that as we did before as a kinetic energy. So just multiply through by that 1 minus 2 gm over rc squared factor. And we get r dot squared plus v of r equals e squared, this constant e squared. So I'm multiplying through by this factor, pulling the e squared over to the right. The e squared is multiplying that lz factor. And so what I get is that v of r is equal to c squared 1 plus lz squared over r squared c squared 1 minus 2gm over rc squared. And this here for a photon, this is a zero. So mass of particle and photon both obey equations for a particle in an effective potential. But for the photon, the potential is slightly different. So if we sketch that for a massive particle, v of r versus r, then you see at very large r, this guy is going to dominate. So it goes like 1 minus 2gm over r at large r. That's just the Newtonian gravitational potential. As you come into smaller r, this term is going to get bigger and bigger. And finally, this term will beat that term. And at very small r, you're going to get minus 1 over r cubed as the potential. OK, so small r, it goes like minus 1 over r cubed. Large r, it goes like c squared. Larger, it goes like c squared times 1 minus 2gm over r c squared. So it will do this. And you see, as I come in from large r, I have minus 1 over r here. But then I have a plus 1 over r squared. So as r decreases, this positive term is going to start beating that term. And so it's actually going to go up. And then it's going to go down to the minus 1 over r cubed. So that's the effective potential. And you can see that if E squared is bigger than c squared, so E is the energy of the particle in this potential. So if the energy is bigger than c squared, then the orbit is unbounded. There are two types of orbits. One is coming in from infinity, bouncing off the hill, going back out. And the other is just being stuck inside the black hole. If e squared is less than c squared, or unbounded. So let's write it this way. For large e squared, I'll just draw it on the picture. So you have, for large E squared, you just have orbits like this, which go out or maybe come in. For intermediate E squared, there are these two orbits. As I lower E squared, I get the most interesting orbits, which are oscillating back and forth between two boundaries or stuck in the black hole. Yep.
When you have this constraint right here, right? And then you are defining your effective potential like that.
Yes.
It is only valid whenever R is not the gravitational radius, right?
When R is?
Not the gravitational radius.
Not equal to that?
Right, because if...
Yeah, okay, so you see, if I go through the algebra, let's look what happens when R is equal to the short shell radius. Wait. Look at this picture, right? This is RS. R equals RS, right? V equals zero at R equals RS. Nothing strange there.
In the constraint, right? Then if I have R equals to RS, then the E squared part goes to zero, the R dot squared goes to zero, and I have that R squared.
No. R equals RS, this part goes to infinity. That part goes to infinity. It's the inverse of one. Okay, so this goes to infinity, that goes to infinity, but they cancel. No problem. Okay? So this is actually the first indication that R equals RS is not any problem. It's just a coordinate singularity. R is a bad coordinate. Mm-hmm.
So the
actually, it's not R that. Yeah, R is actually a fine coordinate. but the problem was that we used the coordinate T, and we'll see. We'll fix that problem. Okay, so for the moment, just view this region below R equals RS as an extrapolation. Okay, the extrapolation to R less than RS looks fine. Okay. Hello, Brian. Okay, so. We can solve this very easily.
So, the behavior for very large E, where it just sort of comes in and goes back out.
It doesn't go back out, right?
Okay.
So very large R. You see, you have both the angular momentum and the E. Now, if I set, so it's very important what the ratio is, okay? And the ratio essentially is determined by the impact parameter. So you see, as I raise up the angular momentum, this bump pushes further up. So at large angular momentum, that's saying the impact parameter is big. I'm just going to miss the black hole. And basically, this barrier due to L is what stops R going small. If L is too small, if the angular momentum is too small, you're coming in with a small impact parameter, you're going to just sail straight into R equals zero and hit R equals zero, which is a singularity. That's all encoded in this picture.
So basically what it's saying is with large enough energy, if you aim right, you're bound to get inside the, okay.
Exactly. And it's all, but you have to be very careful to balance, you know, compare energy to the angular momentum, the other free parameter. Okay, so let's solve this. So, solution, it's very similar to the way that Newtonian orbits are solved. Instead of treating R as a function of T, replace it with R as a function of phi. Okay, so we're going to think of phi. We're going to think of parameterizing our orbit by the angle. So if I sort of look down on the orbit, if this is phi, then I'm going to write my radius r as a function of phi. So this is a nice trick for solving the problem. Now, of course, we have Lz is r squared phi dot. So it follows that r dot squared is r prime squared. I'm going to write prime is d by d phi. And r dot squared is r prime squared times phi dot squared, which is r prime squared Lz squared over r to the fourth. And so now we can use our energy equation, this one, to derive an equation for dr d phi squared. And the second step, so this is the first step, to replace r of t with r of phi. The second step is to define u as 1 over r. It turns out that the Newtonian problem becomes simple harmonic motion if you just set u equal to the inverse radius instead of the radius. Okay, it's one of the strange things about the 1 over r potential. So doing that, r dot squared, you would guess that from here, right? So this is Lz squared times u prime squared. So now if I go back to this equation, let's call that star. And star becomes Lz squared u squared plus, and then the v squared is c squared 1 minus 2 gm u over c squared multiplied by 1 plus L squared, Lz squared, u squared over c squared. And this gives us that u prime squared equals e squared minus c squared over Lz squared minus u squared plus 2 gm u over Lz squared plus 2 gm u cubed over c squared. And so in this form, you notice that the first two terms, this term and this term, are independent of c. These are the usual Newtonian terms. This is just a constant, which doesn't really matter. These two terms are the ones which control the evolution of u as you follow an orbit. And this one is the relativistic correction. The last one is the relativistic correction. So to solve that equation, differentiate with respect to phi to eliminate this constant. And what we get is that u double prime, I'm going to drop a factor of 2 because I get twice u prime u double prime. Let's drop the factor of 2 and the u prime. So I get u double prime is minus u from this term. And then I get plus gm over Lz squared from this term, dropping the u prime. And then from the last term, I get 3 gm over c squared u squared. So that's the equation we have to solve. So we're going to solve this. Solve as an expansion in 1 over c squared. So let's imagine the speed of light is very large. It's usually a good approximation. The particle is moving much more slowly than the speed of light. and then drop the last term. Then we just have to solve this equation, which is an ordinary a linear equation. And the last term will be a perturbation, and we'll calculate the correction in perturbation theory. Okay, so U is going to be U naught, which is the solution without this term, plus 1 over c squared times U1. So it'll be an expansion in 1 over c squared. So what is U naught? Well, this equation here is just a harmonic oscillator, but it's a harmonic oscillator which has been displaced, right? This harmonic oscillator likes to sit still, will sit still, if U equals this. So the minimum of the harmonic oscillator is where this term balances that term, right? So if I just define, so the solution, I'll write down the solution. The solution is where these two things balance, gm over lz squared. That's the inhomogeneous solution plus the homogeneous solution, delta u, which is constant times cosine phi. I'm going to pick that phase of phi is arbitrary. Could have been cosine phi plus a constant. I don't really care about the phase. So let's just pick it to be cosine phi. And then by definition, we say this is gm over lz squared 1 plus e cosine phi, where this is the ellipticity of the odd orbit. Okay, so e is just a constant parameterizing by how much the orbit is deviating from a circular orbit. You see, so this part is a circular orbit, where r is a constant. Sorry, it's actually this part is circular orbit. And the cosine phi just tells me that as I go around phi, the radius is getting bigger and smaller and bigger and smaller and bigger and smaller periodically. And so this is an ellipse. Okay, so if r equals a over 1 plus e cos phi, remember u is 1 over r, this is an ellipse. And e is the ellipticity. So let me write it this way, r naught. If r is some radius r naught over 1 plus e cos phi, that's an ellipse. Okay, so we've solved the Newtonian problem without the 1 over c squared term. Let's now solve the 1 over c squared term. So I plug this formula for u into this equation and equate the coefficients of 1 over c squared. So I'm going to get u1 double prime equals minus u1 from here. This constant term was canceled by the u0 solution. And then over here, I've got to plug in the u0 solution. So plus 3gm over c squared u0 squared. U0 squared makes this into gm squared over lz to the fourth. 1 plus e cosine phi squared. Okay? So I'm just working out the correction u1. Now, when you look at this equation, you've got a harmonic oscillator. U1 is a harmonic oscillator. It's being driven. Yep?
Do you not plug in the u0 plus u1 because you only want to keep the terms up to 1 over c squared?
U1, you see, if I put this substitute this u into here, the u1 term is going to give 1 over c to the fourth. So I don't care about that. So I can always substitute a power series. That would be u2, right? Over 1 over c to the fourth u2. So u2 will be sourced by the 1 over c to the fourth. Right, so look at this equation. I've got a harmonic oscillator. Phi is like the time in the harmonic oscillator. It's being driven by a force, and this force is oscillating. It has various pieces. It has a constant force. I don't really care much about that because that's just a, you know, if I have a harmonic oscillator and I just push it one way, it just gets a little displaced. The displacement doesn't grow. It has a cosine phi squared term that's oscillating at twice the frequency of the harmonic oscillator. This has frequency one, angular frequency one. The term which matters is the cosine phi. Okay, why does it matter? I'm driving the oscillator with a term of the same frequency as the oscillator. What happens? Resonance, okay? So the term that matters is the cosine phi. Okay, because then you get, it's driving the oscillator at the frequency of the oscillator. Resonance. Okay, so that's what Einstein realized, is that this relativistic correction actually builds over the orbits. And this led to the most, probably the most dramatic early test of general relativity. Amazing confirmation of general relativity based on astronomical observations of the 19th century. So let's write it this way. U1 double prime equals minus U1 plus epsilon cosine phi. That's the interesting term. It's the resonant term. And then it's easy to see that the solution to this equation is epsilon over 2 phi sine phi. Okay, so it's an oscillation, but one with growing amplitude, and that's because of the resonance. So I'll just leave you to check that. If you plug this into this equation, differentiate, you will recover the first equation. And so that tells us that U is approximately gm over lz squared, 1 plus e cos phi, that was our Newtonian solution, plus, and now just reading off what epsilon is, it's that 3gm thing over there, 3gm squared e over lz squared c squared phi sine phi. Have I got that right? So I should have got, why didn't I get a factor of 2? Well, yes. So I got a factor of 2 from expanding this out, and I get 2e cos phi. But then the solution has an epsilon over 2, which cancels the 2. So so that's the whole solution. Now, the tricky part, you see, how do I interpret this growing perturbation of the solution? To do that, so imagine that this coefficient here is really very small, okay? It's minuscule, this correction. To interpret the second term, remember the trig formula, that cosine of phi plus a constant is cosine phi cosine the constant minus sine phi sine the constant. Okay, and the constant here is this whole quantity, okay, including the phi. And so you can put all of this together. This is approximately, well, let's do the whole thing. This is approximately 1 plus e cos phi, 1 minus and this is all inside the cosine now, 3gm squared over lz squared c squared. Okay, because as I said, cosine of A minus B is cos A cos B. Now, if B is very small, cos B is 1. But then I also get plus sine A sine B. And if B is small, sine B is just B. And so this is approximately true as long as this whole correction is small. And so you see the effect of this resonance is actually to change the orbit of the change the orbit of the change the orbit of the particle around the mass, so that in the Newtonian picture you would get an ellipse. Okay, so this is Newton. R equals R naught over 1 plus E cos phi. But in GR, when phi changes by 2 pi, the radius doesn't come back to itself. Okay? The radius comes back to itself when phi changes by more than 2 pi, a little bit more than 2 pi. And so what that means is that in GR, the orbit looks like So the radius comes back to the maximum radius when phi is 2 pi plus a bit, right? So then we're going to, not going to draw this very well, like this. So it's precessing, okay? So this is GR. So according to GR, planets do not follow elliptical orbits. They follow whatever they're called. They follow precessing orbits. Let's do this. And so let's work out quantitatively what is the precession of the orbit of a planet, the precession, meaning the change in phi per phi of the, let's say, maximum radius. With each per orbit, so delta phi is going to be this number. So phi changes by 2 pi, delta phi is 6 pi gm over lz squared. Sorry, gm over lz squared. C 1 over c squared, that's equal to 6 pi gm over r naught c squared. So r naught is the average radius of the orbit. You could think about it that way. And so for a well, it's really given by that formula. So R naught, the maximum radius is R naught over 1 minus E, and the minimum is R naught over 1 plus E. GM over R naught is, roughly speaking, the velocity of orbit of the planet. gm over r is roughly v squared. And so this number is of order v squared over c squared. And it's largest, so it's of order v squared over c squared, v orbit squared. And it's largest for smallest r, r naught. So the effect is biggest. You see this m here is the mass of the sun. So the effect is biggest if you think about a planet which is as near as possible to the sun. And that's Mercury. And so for Mercury, if one plugs in the number, you you obtain delta phi is equal to 42.98 arcseconds per century. Okay, so Mercury is orbiting the delta phi. So yeah, I didn't define the delta phi very well. This angle here is delta phi. Delta phi is the shift in the principal axis of the ellipsoid. And it's 42.98 arc minutes per century. And the observations of the 19th century had discovered an anomaly of 43 arc seconds, known. So this anomaly was discovered in the 19th century. So you can kind of imagine being Einstein doing this calculation, saying, oh, it's not quite elliptical. It's not quite an ellipse. It precesses. And working out the number, and then asking an astronomer, does Mercury's orbit precess? And the answer was yes by 43 arc minutes. And that's exactly what the prediction is. So arc minutes. So pretty amazing discovery. And if Einstein needed anything to convince him that he was on the right track, that was it.
For reference, what's our current angular resolution of these kinds of quantities?
This number?
Yeah, I mean, how hard was that number to measure in the 19th century?
I don't know. We have an astronomer with us. He can answer.
That was pretty easy to measure then. Because you have many, it goes around 88 once every 88 days. And so astronomers could easily do sub-arc second measurements.
Even sub-arc second.
Oh, yeah.
How big a telescope do you need to get sub-arc second?
It just depends on the quality of the telescope. You don't have to get a telescope to do this.
You don't need a big telescope.
So you don't need a big telescope.
No. Using light, yeah. Just using ordinary light.
I think it was Simon Newcomb at the Naval Observatory.
Who is that, Simon?
I think it was Simon Newcomb.
Newcomb.
Who, if he didn't make the observations, did a lot of the calculations. I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
At the U.S. Naval Observatory.
Okay. By the way, this remained controversial. I mean, it wasn't as clear-cut as I'm explaining. Nothing ever is. So even though this coincidence was definitely very striking, people thought that maybe the precession is due to other effects. It could be, for example, the quadrupole moment of the sun. If the sun really wasn't perfectly spherical, then the sun had some lumpiness inside it. As that lumpiness moves around, it could, in fact, be pulling on the planet and altering the Newtonian prediction. So Bob Dickey, as late, I believe, as the 1960s, was arguing that maybe this was a coincidence and that maybe some generalized version of Einstein's theory would fit better if you took into account the quadrupole moment of the sun. But as far as I can understand, that whole controversy went away, and the people believe the quadruple moment of the sun doesn't really contribute much to this. And so the original coincidence was, in fact, correct. OK, so we're going to do one other classic test of general relativity, which is the motion of photons. And as I explained, they really only differ by the presence of that one, OK? In that equation up there in the V of R, for photons, there's a zero. OK? So for photons, we can sketch the V of R. That tells us the most general orbit. Where shall I do this? I'll leave that one up. So photons also follow geodesics, just the constraint is different. And for photons, so V of R is equal to LZ over R squared. Times 1 minus yes. Now, as you might guess, you could ask what, well, okay, let's sketch that potential. So it is, at small r, it's minus 1 over r cubed. And as large r, it's, it's minus 1 over r cubed. And large r, it's plus 1 over r squared, because this term wins over that one at large r, right? So it goes like minus, so it goes like this. And notice there's a bit of a funny point on that curve, right? There's a maximum. Where is that maximum? Let's work out the radius. That's where d by dr is 0. dv dr is proportional to, so here I get minus 2 over r cubed. And then here plus, let me write that in a simpler way. It's lz squared over r squared 1 minus r Schwarzschild over r. So it's LZ squared over LZ squared times 1 over R squared minus RS over R cubed, right? That's the 1 over R squared and the 1 over R cubed. So if we ask, where is this stationary? Well, RS is the place where the potential is 0, right? R equals RS. So where's the maximum? That's where minus 2 over R cubed plus plus 3 RS over R to the fourth equals 0. So R squared equals 3 halves R equals 3 halves RS. And 3 halves RS is 3 GM over C squared. OK? So at a radius of 2 GM over C squared, that's the Schwarzschild radius. A radius of 3 GM over C squared, how would you describe this? What is possible at that radius? Circular orbit of a photon, right? So here we have a circular orbit of a photon, right? R equals constant. So we have our black hole at 2 GM over C, at RS. And at 1.5 RS, this photon is happy to continue circulating forever. OK, so that already tells you if Well, the different variety of orbits. That's a special orbit. Tell me why that's very unlikely we'd see that orbit. It's unstable. You perturb it a little bit in radius, and it's either going to fall in or it's going to go out. We have different kinds of orbits. We have photons which do this. So those are ones where the impact parameter is large enough, that the angular momentum is big enough, that this barrier stops them ever hitting r equals 0. We have guys who have, let me just think. Yes, that's right. This quantity E, yep, there are orbits like this too, where you just go from infinity straight into the black hole. There are orbits like this. I'm just puzzling about one thing. I am puzzling because E squared is positive, so that is not allowed. The equation up there says E squared is positive, so we can't have orbits of negative energy. So these are the only orbits which are allowed. Right, so from this there came another equally dramatic prediction.
It could escape, but that's
sorry, didn't
hear.
Say again.
That diagram makes it look as if a photon which is originally at zero but has high enough energy can get out of the black hole. I mean, that's surely not the case.
That is surely not the case. That's a very good point. Likewise with the particle.
Would that solution just be from like reparametrizing a solution with negative T?
Which is falling in. I think it's a great question. Let me think about it. There will be something wrong with that solution, but let's try to figure out what it is. Okay, so yeah, good question. We'll answer that next time. Next time we're going to do even more. We're literally going to follow stuff into the black hole and change coordinates and so on to get rid of the coordinate singularity at RS. So let's keep that question in mind. So a photon, the same procedure. Exactly the same procedure we followed here, but where the one isn't there, leads you to the following equation that U double prime equals minus U plus 3GM over C squared U squared. Yes. And shouldn't be too surprised, U is 1 over R, right? So this right-hand side has a solution, R equals 3GM over C squared. But what we do not have is that term that shifted the center of the harmonic oscillator. So here, U0 is equal to, let's take it equal to sine phi. I could do cosine phi, but it'll be easier to take it to be sine phi. And the interpretation is the following. I have my photon. It's at some radius r this is r equals 0. There's an angle phi, and this is the impact parameter b. And so from this geometry, you see that b equals r sine phi, and that implies that 1 over r is equal to sine phi over b. And that's u. So So that's the zeroth order solution, it's just a straight line. Straight line in polar coordinates looks like u equals sine phi. And now I do the same thing. I plug this into there, and I get u1 double prime plus u1 equals 3gm over b squared c squared sine squared phi. That's, of course, equal to 3gm over 2 b squared c squared 1 minus cosine 2 phi. The particular integral, so I have some oscillation possible in u1. I have a particular integral, which is that u1 equals to 3gm over 2b squared c squared 1 plus 1 third cosine 2 phi. You see, the homogeneous solution I don't really care about because it's just going to give it's just going to give sine phi again, and all it will do is change the coefficient of b. It's just a perturbation in the amplitude b, which was an arbitrary constant anyway. This is the part I care about. And so the solution is u equals 1 over b sine phi, a straight line with impact parameter b, plus u1. And so now, as we go to r equals infinity, so imagine we're following this trajectory. I've got an equation for u as a function of phi. As I go to infinity, I want to know what angle the trajectory is following. Okay, so in particular, if it's bent, then as I go to plus and minus infinity, straight line, if I go to minus infinity would be phi equals pi, plus infinity would be phi equals 0. A bent line will change those numbers. So r equals infinity means u goes to 0. If u is 0, let me see. So phi equals 0 corresponds to, u equals 0 corresponds to phi equals 0 in the solution without the u1. So let's take that. So phi, let me see. Phi equals 0. Right. Phi equals 0 plus, how do I say this? Take u to 0, okay? So I've got to solve this equation. 0 equals this equation as a function of phi. Now, without this term, the solution would be phi equals 0, okay? But with this term, I've got a constant, and you can see that if phi is of order epsilon, much less than 1, that's what I expect, is phi is some very small number, then this becomes 1/3, and the whole quantity here becomes 4/3. And so basically, this equation turns into, let's say, phi is epsilon. So sine phi is epsilon. So I have 0 equals to epsilon over b plus 3gm over 2b squared c squared multiplied by 4/3. And so this gives me that epsilon equals to minus 2gm over c squared b. Okay, and that's the deflection in phi. So basically, as I follow the particle to plus infinity, instead of going to phi equals zero, it's going to a bit of a negative phi, small negative phi. It's going to this value of phi. And similarly, so u goes to zero, phi is equal to minus 2gm over c squared b. And u goes to, or phi is equal to pi plus 2gm over c squared b. So what's that saying is that as I go to infinity, the trajectory, here's my particle, the trajectory is bending, and this is 2gm over c squared b, and this is the same angle. Okay, so that we can see that the total bending angle and that mass is the mass of the sun. And if you just put the numbers in, assuming B is grazing the sun, assuming B is equal to the radius of the sun, then this angle is 1.75 arc seconds. So that's the prediction of general relativity, is that a light ray that just grazes the surface of the sun will actually have been bent on its trajectory by that angle. And then in one of the most celebrated experiments, Arthur Eddington, who was Britain's, I think, astronomer royal or something, he was Britain's most famous astronomer, went to, where was it? Somewhere in Africa. Do you remember? I think it was Gambia. Is it Gambia or?
I know that's the direction I'm in, but I don't remember.
It's an African country. I should remember it. But he went to Africa. He observed a solar eclipse. And the eclipse was very handy because the moon blots out the sun. And so you can see the stars just next to the surface of the sun. And so he took plates showing the locations of the stars right next to the sun. And then he took, and other stars, of course. And then he took plates when the sun was out of the picture of the same set of stars. And his claim was that the stars were deflected, the stars just next to the sun were deflected in angle on the sky by exactly this amount, within error bars. And that was in 1920. And again, that was a very dramatic confirmation of general relativity. Again, it was very controversial. Other people claimed that Eddington had actually somehow faked the data to agree with the theory. But in the long run, Eddington turned out to be right. And this is another spectacular confirmation of GR. And in fact, today, this method of gravitational lensing of the bending of light by heavy objects is absolutely fundamental in cosmology. And we see bending everywhere. And so if you look at big clusters of galaxies, the things Brian studies, very, very often you will see what's called an Einstein ring, where we're looking at this cluster. It's a big, massive cluster. There's some galaxy behind it. my galaxy, and light is bent around the cluster of galaxy, and when you look at the cluster, what you see is a perfect ring. And the ring, or you see multiple images. You see either a ring, if you're very lucky, or you see separate arcs. And in some cases, they see 10 or 20 separate arcs, which all have identical spectra, and they look like they're just the same galaxy, but seen through a lens. It's just like, in fact, everyday example is if you're sitting in the bath and you have drops of water on your fingers and you hold up the drops of water to the light, you'll see the same image of the light in each drop. That's another example of strong lensing, and it's exactly what's seen in cosmology. It's a very, very powerful tool. So even though we can't see the dark matter, we can't see water, right? But we know if a glass is full or empty of water because of the lensing. And it's exactly the same with the dark matter in the universe. We can see it just as well as we can see water. We can't drink it, unfortunately. Okay, so any questions? Okay, so next time we will go into the black hole.